Welcome to the Humanist Union of Madison, and welcome to our listeners on WIDE-LP. Our speaker today will be introduced by Carol Smith.
Hi, I'm Carol Smith from Mequon, Wisconsin. I'm here to introduce Lori Littman Brown. Lori is a lawyer, an educator who served as Nevada State Senator from 1992 to 94, and was named Civil Libertarian of the Year by the Southern Nevada Chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union, and Legislator of the Year by the Nevada Chapter of the National Association of Social Workers. Brown is also the recipient of the Bill DeWolf Award for her work on lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender issues from Interweave Continental, a UUA affiliate. She has been a frequent political commentator on television and radio. Lori was hired by the Secular Coalition for America in September 2005. She directs the coalition's activities and lobbies members of the Congress on issues arising out of the inappropriate incursion of religion into civil law. She also addresses the interests and concerns of America's atheists, humanists, freethinkers, and other non-theists through media appearances and speaking engagements such as the one at Prairie. Member organizations in the Secular Coalition for America include the American Humanist Association, Atheist Alliance International, the Freedom from Religion Foundation, the Institute for Humanist Studies, the Military Association of Atheists and Freethinkers, the Secular Student Alliance, Secular Web Internet Infidels, and the Society for Humanistic Judaism.
Thanks, Carol. I want to preface today's talk with two thank yous to people that are in this room. The first to Mel Littman, who's also my father, for having taken his children to the Unitarian Church, I guess it was called, in Hollis, New York, when we were 10 years old, and starting our real education in world religions and all of the things that have helped me so much in my own education and being able to discuss theological types of things intelligently. And of course, introducing us also to the social justice component of Unitarian Universalism, which has kept my family very involved for many years. And on that note, I also want to thank artist and Teresa Kaufman, who are very involved in the Social Justice Network, or Social Action Network, of the Unitarian Universalist Congregation of Las Vegas. And in fact, I believe Teresa, at least, probably both of them, had a lot to do with my being nominated for the DeWolf Award. And so I really appreciate that as well. When the Secular Coalition for America was formed, there were already a number of highly effective organizations working on Capitol Hill to protect separation of church and state. Some were explicitly religious, like the Interfaith Alliance, the Baptist Joint Committee for Religious Liberty, and yes, the Unitarian Universalist Association of Congregations fits into that category somewhat. Some were neither explicitly religious nor non-religious, like Americans United for Separation of Church and State, though they are led by a reverend from the United Church of Christ, Barry Lynn. And the two lobbyists that I did start working with from Americans United did both happen to be religious Jews. So while part of the mission of the Secular Coalition for America is to protect and strengthen the secular character of government as the best guarantee for all, if that were our only goal, we would be somewhat redundant. We were formed so that when lobbyists on the Hill discussed church-state issues, instead of claiming that people of all religions deserve equal treatment, or claiming that whatever God you believe in, you deserve rights, there would now be a voice for those with no religion, or whose religious identification included no deity belief, and both the conversation and the way we were treated throughout the United States would begin to change for the better. But we were hoping to work with theistic allies. No struggle for minority rights has ever been won without support from the majority. Consider how many young black men had already been killed during the struggle for African American civil rights before the killing of white freedom riders, including Reverend James Reeb, drew the ire of our nation. And men had to vote to give women the vote. And if only 10% of the population were fighting for LGBT equality, the number of states who now have employment non-discrimination on their books would be much smaller right now. Plus, we are not an anti-religion group, Secular Coalition, Perhaps in hiring me, the board of the Secular Coalition was showing that we embraced our religious allies. Since I had been a member of Unitarian Universalist congregations for over 3 decades and had physically participated along with religious groups on homeless projects, soup kitchens, and labor rallies, I was an example of how non-theists can work towards the same societal goals as theists with respect for each other along the way. So I was especially pleased when on my first day on the job, September 19, 2005, I was invited to participate in briefings and coordination with the church-state separation groups already in existence. As I walked from a briefing on vouchers to another on religious discrimination in Head Start, I also balanced my cell phone, giving interviews with reporters throughout the day, and coordinating my first national television appearance that evening on Fox's Big Story. And that appearance allowed me to talk about the morals and ethics of non-theists, because they actually asked me, if you were in water up to your neck during Hurricane Katrina, wouldn't you be praying? So I answered, well, no, I'd be trying to get out of the water. But then I went on to say, well, and plus the fact that we don't believe that we can rely on an outside power to make things happen is one of the reasons why so many humanist and atheist groups have raised so much money and gone to Louisiana to try to help. So it was nice being able to do that on my first day. On the second day on the job, I was lobbying with these other church-state organizations, and it felt wonderful that the atheist lobbyist was being introduced around a table with the Baptist, the Sikh from the Interfaith Alliance, the Unitarian Universalist, and other allies, and they would get my card, which says across the middle, atheists, humanists, freethinkers, Americans, and they would get the Baptist card, and there we all were in one conversation. The congressional staffers we met with on the first 5 lobby visits that day all accepted me as simply another professional representing another constituency which also had the right to be heard by their congressional representatives. This has a lot to do with how the Secular Coalition for America conducts itself. When we lobby, we address how specific bills and specific congressional issues affect us. I have no interest in discussing or arguing about personal beliefs with those who happen to hold differing beliefs from my own when I walk into a congressional office. We can easily coexist as long as others don't impose their theology on me or my government. And now that I've met about half of the U.S. senators face-to-face, as well as dozens of House representatives, and now that I've participated in hundreds of lobby visits over the course of my first 2 years as director of the Secular Coalition, I can honestly say that I have been treated with respect and professionalism by everyone I've lobbied, and I continue to work side by side with theistic allies in the struggle to protect church-state separation in the United States. The media frenzy hasn't died down completely since that first day, but it is more manageable now that we're no longer brand new. We've been covered in the Washington Post, the Christian Science Monitor, front page on the San Francisco Chronicle. We've been covered internationally in London, Ireland, the Netherlands. I recently had a letter to the editor published in the New York Times, which I've left copies of for you. And I also have been appearing on a lot of different radio stations, including Christian radio, conservative radio, as well as the stations you would think as our audience, including some local public radio in Minneapolis and Cleveland. I've also had fun on the O'Reilly Factor 3 times now. I say fun because I always do pretty well on there. But O'Reilly's producers are always hesitant to use me because they tell me I come off as too nice, and they want to show angry atheists. it may hurt them when they're attempting to portray atheists as unreasonably angry, although certainly non-theistic Americans have many reasons to be angry. It certainly helps to sound reasonable when you're speaking on national television. In fact, this kind of double standard really occurred to me in a recent article in the Washington Post. The author of the article, after noting actions by religious extremists, such as the attacks of September 11th, then noted that some atheists are also extremists. She cites this specific example of atheist extremism. Some atheists are crossing out "In God We Trust" on their money. Now, I have to tell you, if this were extreme, I mean, now, and she was comparing this to religious extremists who bomb buildings. If this were the extent of religious extremists, I would be celebrating. It would be great if religious extremists wrote death to infidels on all their money instead of blowing people up. I'd love it. The only national media television appearance I made on which I felt that the host was truly ridiculous, though, was Tucker Carlson's The Situation Room. Instead of seeking information about any issue, he wanted to know what I say when someone sneezes. And then he ended the segment with a sweeping denigration of all Muslims, something that had nothing to do with me, but that even I found offensive. I wonder how Mr. Carlson would feel about the latest addition to the Secular Coalition for America's advisory board, author Salman Rushdie. Would Carlson see this non-theist from an Islamic background as better or worse for having left his God belief? It would be a very interesting mind game for Mr. Carlson, I'm sure. The entire list of media that the Secular Coalition for America has received during its first 2 years is too long to recount here, but I would encourage everyone to take a look at the complete listing of the media we've gotten at secular.org, which also includes the podcasts we've done, and they also get a really great reception. So let me talk to you for a moment about some of the issues that we've worked on. When I began, Hurricane Katrina was a recent tragedy. Sending federal money to religious schools became extremely problematic following Katrina. Religious schools throughout the country saw the plight of displaced students as a way to ensure government funding for religious education. They lobbied Congress to pass vouchers, which for some schools in some parts of the country covered the entire tuition for parochial education. So they could not even pretend that it was only covering secular subjects and not the religious training included in the curriculum. Our lobby, along with other church-state separation groups and education groups, which were able to show that public schools throughout the country were able to accommodate all of these students, were unable to stop the first year's vouchers. But during that lobbying, we also secured a promise from congressional leaders that the funding would not be extended beyond that year. And that helped to kill an attempt to continue the vouchers when the year was up. We had already seen the writings of some religious education folks who foresaw that once government funds were funneled to their schools for the Katrina emergency, they actually wrote these things. All they would have to do after that was always claim that there was some other emergency, or that the emergency was continuing and government money could become a steady income stream for their schools. Although extension of the Katrina vouchers were stopped, government funding of parochial schools in D.C. continues, federal funding. In fact, the Catholic Church has bragged that the federally funded vouchers saved their religious education system. So the next step on this front that we're working on is to stop funneling all of our tax dollars to teach individual children their religious texts when the program approaches reauthorization this coming year. And by the way, if you get a chance to speak to those who don't see a real problem with subsidizing religious training with tax dollars, ask them to consider the situation in Holland, which funds all schools, both religious and secular. This became a major problem when government-funded Islamic refugee schools taught the subjugation of women, along with intolerance of religious diversity, in contravention to the values of that country. They are still grappling with the ramifications of their decision to open the government coffers to religious indoctrination. And have any of you read Ayaan Hirsi Ali's book, The Infidel? There's a really good description of how that plays out in there. I got to meet her last week. She's absolutely wonderful. She's in Holland now. She was in D.C. for an event two weeks ago. Another battle which came early on was Head Start. The fight over civil rights protections in the federal Head Start bill was being waged before I came on the scene. By the time I started lobbying against repeated attempts to strip the bill of its protection against religious discrimination in hiring teachers, the issue had already been fought for a number of years. And the bill had not seen a reauthorization during that time because even supporters of the program did not want to risk it getting through without its civil rights protections intact. This year, for the first time in half a dozen years, Head Start was reauthorized, and through a concerted effort of a number of organizations, not just the Secular Coalition, it did not include the religious discrimination amendment. Now, you may be wondering at this point why any member of Congress, and this discrimination did pass the House years before, but then got stopped in the Senate, but you may be wondering why any member of Congress would support religious discrimination in hiring with federal funds. That's not how the folks who wanted to discriminate framed it. They claimed that since their religion required them to prefer those who shared their beliefs, or since they weren't comfortable working with those who had differing beliefs, that when they accepted federal money to run a federal program, it would be interfering with their free exercise of religion to tell them that they had to base their hiring decisions on who were the best teachers. Or in the case of Head Start, which also helps lift families out of poverty by turning volunteer parents into Head Start teachers, whoever would be most deserving of the job based on a number of reasonable factors, rather than letting them only hire people from their church or people who follow their religious tenets. Thus, in their mind, a single mother might be denied a job because she had a child out of wedlock. They also tried to confuse the hiring of federally funded Head Start teachers with the one area of employment in which churches are, and rightfully so, able to discriminate. When a religious organization raises its own funds to run its own church programs, they may choose their employees based on religion. It would be absurd to apply religious employment discrimination law to require a Catholic church to hire a Hindu to be its priest. But no church is required to apply to run a secular education program, which is funded 100% by the government. And if a religious organization is uncomfortable following federal employment law when they administer such a program, then they ought not to take that on. A similar perversion of the constitutional guarantee of free exercise of religion was raised when the House of Representatives last year passed an amendment to the Department of Defense spending bill, which would have allowed military chaplains to proselytize unwilling soldiers anytime, anywhere, in any context. The chaplains who lobbied for this amendment claimed that their particular religion, they were for the most part born-again Christian evangelicals, required that they work at all times and in all places to save all non-Christians. And by the way, their definition of non-Christians included anyone who is not identified as born again. Therefore, if they were told that while working in a government capacity, they could not proselytize Jewish, atheists, and other what they call unchurched soldiers, then their free exercise of religion would be curtailed. The problem, of course, with this logic is that their religion doesn't require them to seek work as a military chaplain. Obviously, given their beliefs, a more appropriate job would be to serve as a privately funded missionary or minister and not take a job in the government, where the other part of the religious constitutional protection, a prohibition of establishment of government religion, must also be enforced. In fact, an Episcopal priest and friend of mine who had served as a military chaplain was especially concerned that if this amendment went into effect, it would endanger the entire military chaplaincy program, because a 1980s court case held that the only reason it is constitutional to fund military chaplains is to accommodate the free exercise of religion of the soldiers, not the chaplains. And military chaplains are not permitted to proselytize soldiers who do not seek their theological doctrine. Eventually, in a wonderfully bipartisan move, Senator John Warner, a Republican from Virginia, got the amendment to allow military chaplains to proselytize deleted from the final bill. However, the attempt to make our military into a Christian revival camp has not ceased. Pentagon officials, some of whom believed that the Christian Embassy was a quasi-federal organization, recently misused their uniforms and their endorsements in a fundraising video for that organization. One of these officers even said in the video, which was distributed widely via the internet, that he places his God above his country. It is not surprising that when one of these Christian embassy endorsers was assigned to work in Turkey, he was not well received there. And when atheist and American hero Pat Tillman was killed in Afghanistan by friendly fire, the cover-up of the true circumstances was exacerbated by insults hurled at Tillman's family by Lieutenant Colonel Kauslerich, one of the early investigators of that killing, who claimed in an ESPN.com interview that the Tillman family was only pushing for the truth about their son's death because they didn't believe in heaven and felt their son was just worm dirt and therefore couldn't let it go and get over it and just believe he was in a better place. Now, I don't know whether such comments are more insulting to Tillman's family or to those who have lost a family member who do believe in heaven, but also don't appreciate being lied to. But the more disturbing information, which was uncovered during one of the investigative hearings recently conducted by Congressman Waxman and his investigative committee, was that this same officer, Kauslerich, happened to be one of the first investigators in Afghanistan to look into the killing. And that between the time of the killing and the short time it took for a report to reach the United States, someone had changed an eyewitness account of what really happened. After being, yet another problem going on in the military, and this is actually in litigation at the moment, after being told to leave the Thanksgiving dinner, a Thanksgiving dinner, for not participating in a prayer, an atheist soldier in Iraq decided he needed to talk to others like himself and got the appropriate approvals to hold a free thought meeting. However, when his fellow soldiers showed up, he and they were threatened with punishment and told they would not be permitted to hold such meetings. When he embarked on a lawsuit to protect his rights, the pressure got worse, and he eventually felt that his life was in danger, not from the usual perils of serving in Iraq, but from his fellow soldiers and officers. He was transferred to the United States recently for his own protection, where although he is more likely to be safe in general, he is also less likely to advance in military ranks. In fact, soldiers who achieve the level of Eagle Scout in the private religious organization Boy Scouts of America receive higher pay when they enter the military than do those who are not permitted to join the Scouts for religious reasons. Although the Secular Coalition for America serves as a voice for non-theists, we have taken note also of the abhorrent treatment of Wiccans in the military as well. Roberta Stewart from Nevada lost her husband to war, but after that tremendous sacrifice, Ms. Stewart then had to wage a personal war with her own government to get them to allow her husband's religious symbol to be placed on his grave marker in the Veterans Cemetery. Atheists and humanists had already had their symbols approved when this Wiccan widow was finally permitted to honor her husband's life in the way most appropriate to his beliefs. You may have read, however, that when President Bush recently visited Reno, Nevada, he inadvertently failed to invite Roberta Stewart to a meeting he had with the rest of her family. Although he did call to apologize for the alleged oversight, I have to wonder what kind of a person or institution thinks of everyone in a fallen soldier's family except the widow who gave her life's partner. At this time, with thousands and thousands of complaints regarding an atmosphere of Christian crusading in our diverse military, the Secular Coalition for America is working with the Armed Services Committee, as well as the Oversight and Investigations Committees, as well as some members of the Veterans Affairs Committees, to ensure that the men and women who serve our nation receive our respect and that their freedom of religion and conscience is respected. The other truly massive undertaking that we're working on with the government oversight investigators is dealing with problems associated with the White House's faith-based initiatives. In 2001, the president declared that faith-based groups were not on an equal footing with secular service providers when it came to applying for government grants to administer social services. This was not true. Charitable choice provisions under the Clinton administration had put religious and secular organizations on the same footing when it came to applying for these grants. Nonetheless, the rhetoric worked, and those who believed they were following the administration's wishes began a concerted effort to shift social service grants away from proven secular organizations like the Boys and Girls Clubs and shift them to any religious organizations, regardless of how shaky their practices might be or what kinds of results they might achieve. The best example of a clearly ideologically based money shift was the large grant given to Pat Robertson's Operation Blessing. We are now working to uncover the political and ideological basis for grant making, which appears to be rampant at this time. The U.S. Supreme Court recently, in throwing out the case of Hine versus Freedom from Religion Foundation, declared that as long as government funds were being spent by executive branch agencies, taxpayers would not be allowed to challenge whether these procedures discriminated against the non-religious. So it is clearly left in the lap of Congress to take action when community grant making is done in an unconstitutional way. There are four areas specifically that we're very concerned with regarding faith-based initiative. One is an allegation, well, these are all allegations from David Kuo's 2006 book, Tempting Faith. The first, that a number of decision makers would toss out any grant application that wasn't clearly from a Christian group. There's nothing in writing permitting this discrimination, but if the individuals making these decisions truly feel that this is their job, the problem is a huge one. The second problem we're dealing with is that even after a General Accounting Office investigation indicated that there was not and is not an unlevel playing field, agency representatives still talk about trying to eliminate barriers to faith-based groups getting money. In fact, the Homeland Security Office of Faith-Based Initiative, we even have that in Homeland Security, which is a scary thought, has eliminating barriers to religious organizations' participation in federal grants as one of its key goals. The problem with this is that the only barriers currently existing are constitutional requirements that federal money not be used to proselytize, and that services given with federal monies must be offered to all who need the service, regardless of the recipient's religion. If we were to eliminate these so-called barriers so that proselytizing organizations can use federal money to attempt to convert social service recipients or to distribute services only to members of their religion, this is unconstitutional. There are numerous religious social service providers who have been using federal funds for many years to provide assistance for decades, actually, and who understand and respect this limitation. Catholic Charities, Jewish Family Services, Lutheran Family Services have been providing service without proselytizing or discriminating in who they give aid to. But apparently, there are groups out there or politicians who think they can win a few votes by claiming there are groups out there who want to both get your tax dollars and use them for their religious purposes. The Secular Coalition for America also participated in opposing the federal marriage amendment last year, taking on the idea that we would put a theological definition onto a civil contract. We also lobbied very hard for stem cell research to be permitted on, obviously, more lines of stem cells, and as I'm sure you're aware, even though Congress is now with us on that, not by a large enough margin to override the president's vetoes. That's a little bit personal for me, as I spent 5.5 years taking care of a mother-in-law with Alzheimer's in my home as the primary caregiver. Not that necessarily stem cells will find a cure, but certainly to say you can't use the best materials possible in your research because someone believes that an egg and a sperm, as soon as they come together, have a soul, is not good for secular law. We've also worked on access to emergency contraception, especially for rape victims, as well as attempting to help defund the ineffective abstinence only until marriage theological curriculums and go to fact-based, age-appropriate sex education. And I have to wonder on the access to legal pharmaceuticals, where pharmacists were using the same rationale that these chaplains were using. Well, my religion says I can't do my job. If a pharmacist does not believe in dispensing legal prescriptions, he or she is not in the appropriate field. And I have to wonder how many people would oppose these pharmacists' actions if they were, instead of refusing birth control prescriptions, refusing Viagra to men who were not married because of belief against out-of-wedlock sex. Yeah, it might be a whole different conversation then. I encourage people, again, to look at secular.org, our website, to see a complete list of the over a dozen, probably a few dozen issues we've been working on. And then, as different as varying Unitarian Universalist congregations are throughout the United States and internationally, the one thing that always seems consistent is UUs are the most active activists. And so I do want to take just a few minutes to suggest how each of you can take action on what's happening in the congressional sphere. The Secular Coalition for America sends out email alerts when we need people throughout the United States to contact their congressional representatives. We don't send them regularly, only when there's a vote coming up for which grassroots action is needed. We just sent one regarding an earmark for a creationist group in Louisiana. You can sign up to get these alerts, and the location to do that on the website is listed on the blue part of the brochures that are on the table, and I hope you all picked up. The actions are very easy, a few mouse clicks and you've sent an email, but if you have time, I urge you to play with the sample letters and personalize them, even though mostly what they do is just count up how many are for and how many are against. So it's just actually specifying the bill that matters most. And it also helps me when people are sending those e-alerts, because when I walk into lobby, then if they've already heard from a few hundred people in our organization from that district, it gives me extra credibility. As well as if any of you are going to ever be visiting DC, call us a few weeks ahead. If you're willing, we'll take you lobbying with us as a constituent so that you're visiting with your particular members, and that's also highly effective. I should mention also that organizations like the Secular Coalition for America have no problem also with checkbook activists, the people who make it possible for someone to serve as a full-time professional paid lobbyist representing you, albeit a low-paid nonprofit lobbyist. Although I did give up a law practice to become a teacher, and that cut my pay in half. To become this nonprofit lobbyist, I also took a pay cut from nonprofit from public school teaching. So you're not spending a ton of money having a lobbyist, but it does help us build what we can do and how much capacity we have if you are capable of being a checkbook activist. Writing letters to the editor and op-eds on issues of importance, speaking up when others denigrate minorities, even non-theists, regardless of whether you fit in that category or not. If you are a non-theistic person, and I just use that as an umbrella term, the way in the LGBT movement we use transgender as this big umbrella. So you can identify however you want if you're non-theistic, free thinker, agnostic, atheist, humanist. But if you identify as one of these, coming out as such when it is comfortable for you to do so, and sometimes even when it's not so comfortable for you to do so, helps begin to eliminate the stereotypes that we're not good neighbors, patriotic Americans, and real nice people. And if you're not a nice person, just keep the non-theistic stuff to yourself. Don't tell anyone. Tell them you're a right-wing or a far-right Christian fanatic. And of course, I know because your UUs vote. I mean, this group and also the Secular Coalition for America is nonpartisan. But look at the issues and vote for the people who will support separation of church and state. When I served in the Nevada legislature, the majority and thus all the committee chairs and all decisions as to what bills would and would not move in the state Senate was divided by less than a dozen voters. So when I hear people say, oh, I'm sure it doesn't matter whether I vote, especially in local elections, it can make a huge difference. So I went a little longer than I meant to, so I'm not going to tell you about the eye-opening experiences I had when I took this job, hearing from people who lived in places I never lived in, like Kansas and Tennessee. I'm not going to go into detail about what they told me about how their kids were pushed in the schoolyard or ostracized or told by their coach they were evil. I mean, I have some lengthier parts to longer talks. But what I do want to do is say that on behalf of the mother in Kansas whose child suffers daily because we have made our public schools into a religious battleground, and the man in Tennessee who nearly cried on the phone to me about how he'd never come out to anyone as a non-theist, I ask you to stand up for our secular government and for these families, and I am so pleased that I have the opportunity to do this full time and work for this new civil rights cause, which hopefully in the next few years will, well, it's already in the first 2 years having an impact. So thank you very much. And I believe we have until 1:30, right?
Well, 1:40 since we started late.
Oh, okay. So we have time for questions and comments.
Have you had contact with Mikey Weinstein?
Yes. In fact, I had contacted Mikey a long time ago, and he kind of like shrugged me off. Like, he didn't really know what we were doing and where the intersection came. And he was very, very busy, of course. By the way, Mikey, how many of you don't know who he is?
No.
Okay. He runs the Military Religious Freedom Foundation.
Yes.
And so you can look at the website for Military Religious Freedom Foundation to get more information about what he's doing. And he mostly, he's a lawyer, and this group is mostly taking lawsuits. When I mentioned the soldier in Iraq who's being treated the way he is, and now he's back in the States, that group and Mikey are handling his lawsuit. So I finally got through to the people who could talk to Mikey and say, Lori can actually help you on the lobbying end of it. And so this week, I'm meeting with two folks from Mikey's group who are going to sift through the 5,000 complaints they've gotten with me. And on Friday of this week, I have meetings with Levin's office, he's the chair of Armed Services, and with Waxman's oversight people, so that we can sit down and figure out how Congress can start addressing this better. I'm so glad we're now working with Mikey.
I had a question about the presumption by the general public, which has been allowed to be delivered, that the prayer breakfasts are sponsored by Congress. And are you involved at all in kind of trying to make that a change? I mean, I think they're almost practically billed as congressional prayer breakfasts, and I doubt that there's very many members of Congress that don't feel an obligation to go to them.
Yeah, it's more a matter of capacity with two full-time staff running a national organization that we haven't addressed that
mm-hmm.
issue.
Sure.
And so it's a little easier to get our influence in some of the other issues that are coming up. But we are concerned about it. I will tell you that there are some members of Congress, in fact, the best person in terms of being against all of this religion and government in that sense happens to be a religious Jew out of Nevada, Congresswoman Berkeley, who when her Democratic caucuses were started with prayer, she objected until they finally stopped doing that because she said, I go home to go to church and temple, you know, and she also visits a lot of churches when she goes home, you know, even though she's Jewish. But this is government. So sometimes those kind of things are better coming from the inside, especially. Yeah, it's mostly a matter of capacity that we don't really, we tried to help her on that matter, but she pretty much took care of it herself.
I have a question about the opening of Congress with a prayer when they open the session, which disturbs me terribly, whereas the In God We Trust thing doesn't bother me half as much. But the regular chaplain for the House of Representatives always gives a non-denominational, sort of this all-secular kind of prayer. He's a retired naval commander, I believe, a black man who's the regular chaplain. But there's some system they have where they have visiting people who come in and give the prayer. And those people will stand up and give Christian prayers, and they end their prayer by in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, Amen, etc. And I've talked to Tabby Baldwin about this, and there has to be someone who should, you know, when you invite someone to give the prayer, I mean, I know all of you really would rather that there's no prayer.
Uh-huh.
I would too, but say there is one.
Well, let me start with Representative Baldwin.
Let me finish my question, though.
I'm sorry. You said that even though we'd prefer there not be a prayer.
The visiting.
Oh, that someone is in charge of asking. Usually, I think it's a congressperson from that particular jurisdiction invites someone from their community to do it. That person needs to give some instruction on, how long do you talk, how long... And they should also be required to say, this has to be a non-denominational prayer. And Tammy Baldwin sort of blew me off and said, this is more or less forget it.
Well, I know...
Any comment?
I can imagine why she said that. I'm looking at Mel because he's worked with interfaith groups in Las Vegas, Nevada, to try to get Nevada to stop doing this Christian prayer thing when they're supposed to do non-sectarian. First of all, let me mention that Dan Barker from Freedom from Religion Foundation has been attempting to work with Baldwin's office to try to get a humanist or a non-theist invocation. Senator Reid got the first Hindu invocation in the Senate he sponsored, and Christians actually heckled the prayer. Yeah, but I'm guessing that the reason Congressman Baldwin is thinking, oh, you can't do anything about these guys, is because when they come in to do the guest prayer, they usually, if not always, know that they're supposed to have a non-sectarian prayer, and they don't care. In fact, they're there because the person who sponsored them wants to do the, ha, we're doing a Christian prayer in Congress, ha ha. Now, right? We experienced this at the state level in Nevada. When I was in the Nevada State Senate, and I don't think anybody at that time even really realized what a humanistic Jew was, so they didn't know I was an atheist, they just knew I was a Jew. In order to kind of set me up, at the end of this 6-month session, they spent 2 weeks praying to Jesus Christ every day, so that I would eventually step outside during the prayer and they could make a big issue out of that. These people who come in and put Jesus into government functions, for the most part, they know exactly what they're doing. And they know exactly how inappropriate and that is.
So my complaint should be not to my congressperson to do something about it, but I should complain to the congressperson who invited the... Because I don't know whether you always know that.
The problem is that the congressperson who sponsors these people probably is from a constituency where they love putting Jesus on government.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Jeff Sessions from Alabama... Actually, people voted in someone who's still a segregationist. I mean, that's where they are in that state, and he wins with huge numbers. I mean, during the marriage amendment, he made a comment that inferred that he was still upset about interracial marriage. I mean, it was just, so they're from these areas where if that's who they're sponsoring, it's probably because their constituents are gung-ho about, you're attacking Christians by not letting us take over the government.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. In the light of all that, it's probably a foolish question, even on my part. This thing in the Pledge of Allegiance, One Nation Under God, mm-hmm. and that only came up in 1951, I think.
54.
So, which is totally modern, which is ridiculous. It could be thrown out, any time, but I guess that would never go through.
Well, that's being challenged again by Michael Newdow. The Secular Coalition filed a friend of the court letter in Newdow's case. He's also challenging on the money and such. And for people to say it really does, it's just ceremonial, people are still using these mottos as a reason why they should be allowed to make this a Christian nation. But also, the public school under God, that's even worse for the kids who are being pushed in the schoolyard and having a cross drawn on this one little girl's head for not saying it, because, you know, to put this, plus historically, you know, I like to point out to people who don't think it's a big deal that historically the pledge was written shortly after the Civil War, and the term, the phrase one nation indivisible had a very special meaning after the Civil War. And then to divide us on who thinks we're under God and who doesn't, especially with school children, it's horrible. However, Newdow is a brilliant lawyer. He's amazing. And I really believe that the reason the Supreme Court threw his first case out on a really new and weird standing rule about who has custody of their children after a divorce, I think it had something to do with the fact that they thought for sure they would hear oral arguments and get briefs from the other side that they could latch on to. But after listening to Michael Newdow and reading his briefs, you couldn't have held for the other side, so they found a way to throw it out. With this new Supreme Court, I don't think they'll have any qualms about not really following the Constitution. But Michael's trying, and we're trying to make people understand that it's not a victimless thing when you tell school children, okay, we're gonna all say under God in public schools.
This gentleman has been trying to say something.
Do you have any observations on our congressional delegation, either Penny Baldwin or our senators, as to how responsive they are, but how we might approach them?
Yeah, with Feinstein and
Feingold.
Big difference.
And Cole.
As well as with Representative Baldwin, you have people who consistently vote supporting separation of church and state. So when you have friendly legislators like that who understand the issues and really work for the issues, it's still important that you contact them,
show support,
thank them when they push the right stuff through. When you said that Dan Barker is going to be here, you might want to ask if he would like to kind of activate more people from Baldwin's district to kind of talk to her a little more about allowing him to do an invocation. Or it doesn't even have to be him. I mean, it could be there's a humanistic rabbi out of Cambridge, Harvard, you know, that could do it, or any non-theist. But basically, it's fantastic. I mean, with a group like the three of them, it's thank yous. It's what can we do to help move this issue? It's nice to have that.
Something I've wondered about, and I know people aren't very long-sighted about this, is there any way of approaching this issue by making the other side see that what sauce for the goose may someday be sauce for the gander? You know what I mean, don't you?
Yeah.
In other words, if they are very open about these things and not restrictive, the time may be coming when they're walked all over.
Groups like the Baptist Joint Committee for Religious Liberty understand this so well. I mean, it used to be the Baptists that had a trouble with not having separation, clear separation. However, we find that when we present this to people who wanted this to be a Christian nation, they don't fear that the Constitution will protect religious minorities. And therefore, if they open up, for example, student prayer to graduation ceremonies, that suddenly you'll have a satanic student giving a satanic prayer. They don't fear that because they're so sure that they have the majority and they have this privileged position in society, and it'll never be a minority group, and no group will ever take over the majority status from Christians because, you know, Jesus makes himself known to everybody, and therefore, yeah, whatever it is. It's sort of making that is almost like a brick wall sometimes because they just don't consider it'll be them. In fact, I remember when we were talking about prayer in the legislature, we said, well, how, or even under God and the Pledge, well, how would you feel if your child came in every day and had to say, one nation under Allah, or, you know, something like that? And they said, we wouldn't have any problem with that. You know, because they know it'll never happen. Yeah. However, for example, there's a lawsuit right now about a huge cross in Mount Soledad in the San Diego area in California on what's now federal land. It used to be county land. It's still illegal. But if someone were to say, well, if you really believe that it's okay for government to erect this structure, then it should be okay for them to erect a pentacle. But people don't worry about that, because that's not going to happen. And that's why I bring up the thing about what's happening in Holland. Because when you look at vouchers, you know, if you give vouchers, you can't say only to parochial schools.
So the fear has to be something more imminent and more obvious. So how do we put the fear of, dare I say, God? Now, I'm serious. It's one way to approach it. And if somebody can think of a good gimmick, what sauce for the goose is indeed a sauce for the gander. Because I would really, you know, I don't want to proselytize either.
Right, right.
Sorry about that, you. But, yeah. You know, I just don't.
Yeah.
But I really wish they'd get off my case. And I don't know how to disturb that smugness that says this will never happen. I find it among people that are not among my close friends, but that I see very regularly in certain activities I participate in. And they just smile in a very smug and superior way. They do not want to discuss whether it's religion or politics, which are pretty much the same for them.
Yeah.
And they look down on me rather patronizingly, whereas, you know, people who think more or less, as I do, we discuss and fight about these things all the time at the top of our lungs. But this other group is so untouchable, and I don't know how to get through that skin.
Maybe the voucher thing is the first place to start, because, you know, if they have to start funding madrasas, they may rethink things.
And then the thing is to get sample groups who will push for that. I mean, who will push for being included.
In localities where vouchers have been implemented, non-theist groups have started opening atheist schools or humanist schools. Mm-hmm. And that's powerful. Quite often, just saying they're going to do that stops the voucher movement in a locality. So, exactly, that does score. Is that what you were going to mention, Mel?
No. You alluded to it earlier. What power we have, there's about 30 to 50 million non-theists in this country. If legislators knew that we were that large a group.
Did you say 1,000?
No, I said
million.
30 million.
Right, okay.
Oh, I'm sorry if I said 1,000. 30
no,
million.
No, you did say it right. Sorry.
Okay, it's approximately 15%. That's the general surveys. Legislators don't realize that. We're larger than the Jews, Buddhists, Muslims, all combined. Mm-hmm. All right? And Lori mentioned earlier in her talk that it's important for us to come out and let people know. I mean, how many of your friends can say some of my best friends are atheists? Okay? They can't because they don't know it. People you work with don't know you're a non-theist. Once it's known, I think legislators will start paying more attention. They just think we're very insignificant, and that's the biggest problem.
When I do my lobby visits, they really are very impressed when I say we represent about 30 million Americans, mm-hmm. at minimum. That is impressive. They do take note.
Yeah. Yeah, that figure is based on what, a Pew Trust study or other academic?
There's a page on secular.org where we go over some of the key polls, because there are so many. And how we came up with, I stick with the 10%, the 30 million, because I think that's a very conservative estimate so that people aren't thinking I'm overdoing it. But take a look, and it goes through which different polls we were looking at and coming up with that as an approximation.
And I had another comment. Some of us were at FFRF this weekend.
Yeah.
And we have one congressperson who is out, basically saying, okay, I'm not a believer, and here I am in Congress.
Representative Pete Stark.
Yes. Yeah. And someone stood up at the meeting who had taken some kind of a poll. They hadn't talked to all of Congress, but they had selected some people they thought maybe fit the category. And I don't remember the exact numbers, but their conclusion was there are many more.
Yes,
are not going public. And that number, I can't remember.
It was 20.
20 people in Congress.
And that's just of the 60 that Woody Kaplan, the chair of our advisory board, asked.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, that's something maybe we can act in some way to try to help them, move them along in the right direction to be more public. Having 10% representation, you know, in Congress would be fantastic.
Right now, you're probably aware that polls taken this year showed that of the minority groups that were being asked about, that the only group that the majority of Americans said, even if someone who was highly qualified were nominated by their own party, they would not vote for anyone from this group for president, was atheists. So until that changes, it's very difficult for anyone to in Congress to be an out non-theist and get reelected. Not difficult for Pete Starr, and there are some other parts of the country where it will not be difficult. But when we ask people that question very quietly, we're very careful to let them know we're not going to out them. You know, but when they feel comfortable that it's okay to make that public, that we want to support that and make it a very positive announcement, like we did with Representative Stark, because the fact that it was all positive press that came from that, I didn't have a lot of copies to lay out there, but there's some headlines on the Stark thing on the table. It was all positive. It had a lot to do with the way the Secular Coalition did the press release and the way we handled the announcement. And so we're very careful to try to make it comfortable for other individuals to do that when they're comfortable doing so.
The Secular Coalition run some sort of contest?
Yes.
That?
In March, one of our advisory board members, Dave Niosi, suggested that we do this contest and ask people to nominate who they thought were the highest level elected officials who were non-theistic in the United States. And whoever nominated the one who was willing to be out and it was accurate that they were non-theist would win a $1,000 prize. And so two people actually, one from California, one from Oregon, both nominated Representative Pete Stark. And when we went through everyone who was nominated and got through asking, is this accurate, are you non-theistic? If so, you know, would you be okay with the world knowing this? The only member of one member of Congress, Pete Stark, said yes to both parts of that. And so, And that was really very exciting because for a while, the yeses we got were from the chair of a school board in Berkeley, California, a city council type person from Maine, and I forget who the third one was, but it was about that same level. Now, there between those two, you know, Congress member and the other three, and we were worried it would end at school board. But between those two, now Ernie Chambers from Nebraska has also signed on with us to tell the world that he's a non-theist, although that really wasn't...
God.
I was going to say, that really wasn't a secret, even before he sued God. So.
Well, you know, I'm listening to this, and the term coming out and so forth pops up. So shall we say at minimum, that 10% non-theist. And I think it's almost the same as gays. Uh-huh. And their coming out took a while. So you have two large groups, at least 20% of the population. You know, if they would get together and just being more honest and courageous of giving the... because, you know, I'm European, I'm German, and I know I live between both cultures. And I know when I go back to Germany, you know, the image of this country has become like a really deadbeat, conformist kind of group. And in my deep heart, I feel the same way. And I think it's just, and I'm also reminded always of the Nazi time, when large numbers were just too scared early enough to come up with what, you know, standing up, taking a stand. And I see this sort of thing, this sort of mindset creeping up around here. And maybe if publicity coming from our side could sort of gently focus on that sort of thing, you know, it might be a gimmick, it might be a way to catch people's attention more, and then the legislators who would realize that they really could have a much larger following. of non-traditional people, oppositional people who speak out?
And one of the things we do when we do our sample emails mm-hmm. on the different issues is the sample email generally identifies the sender as a non-theistic American. Mm-hmm. And as I said, you know, feel free to change that to whatever identification you like, but we felt it was important not just to talk about the issue, but to let them know that there are these, you know, these folks out there. And it really does help when people let their neighbors and friends, if they, you know, if they can, mm-hmm. without getting fired from their job or something, you know this. I see a lot of analogies with LGBT equality and yeah. how much better it got when people started coming forward.
Well, I think that winds up our hour.
Great. Perfect timing.